equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettner, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays, and happy to be back here live in the studio after a couple of Mondays of previous shows were played while I was in vacation with my family in the Boundary Waters canoe area between northern Minnesota and Canada. Lovely place to hang out with nothing but clean air, sunshine, bald eagles soaring overhead, loons, very regenerating. And but I'm glad to be back here in Vermont, and we've got a great show coming up for you today. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil, and it's rare that we have a chance to tackle all three sub-themes, energy, food, local economy, at once in the same show, but that's exactly what we're going to do today. With us in the studio the entire hour is Chris Bray, a state representative from New Haven, and he's a member of the House Agricultural Committee, has been for a couple of sessions now. And one of the things that he helped shepherd through the legislature this year is the Farm-to-Plate Bill, which sets the state's food and agricultural strategy. And another thing that he worked on this last session is the Biomass Energy Development Working Group, looking at what biomass resources do we have here in the state. We send billions of dollars out of state to pay for fuel each year. And how can we keep that money in state, use our biomass resources right now here in the state? They're working on that. And we'll also be talking with a couple other people about these things. Ellen Kaler is a director of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. And the Sustainable Jobs Fund is overseeing the farm, well, she's overseeing the Farm to Plate project. The Sustainable Jobs Fund is carrying it out. So we'll be talking with her. Also later on in the show, when we get to biomass energy, we'll be talking with Gwen Hallsmith. She's a planning director for the city of Montpelier. And the city of Montpelier is planning to heat a large part of the downtown, including some of the state buildings there, with a district heating plant using biomass, hopefully from the state of Vermont. So we'll talk to her about how that works and what the prospects are for doing that. As usual, your phone calls are welcome. The number here in the studio is 244-1777, or if you're outside the Waterbury calling area, toll-free number is 877-291-8255. So how can we keep our energy dollars local, our food dollars local? What can we do to plan to do a better job of that? That will be the theme of today's show. And Chris Bray from New Haven, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carl. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we also have on the line from Montpelier, Ellen Kaler, director of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. Ellen, welcome to Equal Time.
Thank you. Thanks, Carl. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ellen.
Well, let's begin with where this initiative began, which was in the legislature, the Farm to Plate Initiative. And Chris Bray, as a state representative, could you explain how it came to be?
Sure. I think, I'd like to double back and just do a very brief history as to what got me interested in this. After my brother was born in Burlington, my family moved on out of state to Connecticut. And I grew up in New Britain, Connecticut, which the motto of the town was Hardware City of the World. And we had many factories there. The Landers Ferry and Clark plant was 42 acres just adjacent to downtown. It was like a small city. And as I was growing up, these plants were closing. They were basically relocating to the south where they were getting better tax benefits, all that kind of stuff. And we had a net migration out from the town, and the town really suffered. I think it, in a way, as a kid, I watched it lose its heart and soul in terms of what it was doing business-wise. And then I moved to Vermont, went to UVM, and I looked around at, agriculture. And when I was a kid, there were 10,000 dairy farms in Vermont. Now there are 1,000. So as a kid, it was, upsetting to me, really, to watch us lose the heart and soul of that city and not find a way to recover. And I wasn't able to do anything about that. I feel like agriculture is facing a similar challenge right now in Vermont. I mean, we've been losing farms, dairy farms, and you know, I wanted to do something about it.
So Farm to Plate is all about economic development for the agricultural sector in Vermont.
Exactly. You know, there are a lot of other benefits that go along with it, but at the basis of it is community development, economic development for the state of Vermont while we rebuild our food system. So there's, you know, for folks who don't necessarily feel that they're so interested in food, I always think of the Wendell Berry saying, you know, eating is an agricultural act. So
I think most people are pretty interested in food, and it's hard for some of them to translate that into agriculture.
Right, but. Right. And, you know, and the landscape here, too, reflects agriculture. And, well, we're also going to be talking about biomass. So we're 78% forested and about another 15% farmland. So we're up to into the, you know, 92-93% of the state is farm and forest. And it's a great thing to be able to work in an area where it affects so much of the working landscape that we all count on.
Hmm. So what is this Farm to Plate initiative?
Sure. I think it was a surprise to me to learn, and I'm going to use a number of facts and figures today. Some of them they come from a variety of studies. It's hard to know exactly how accurate, so I'll just ask people for a little grace here, and that is to not stick to exact numbers. But based on what I saw, Vermont is importing about 97% of the food that we eat. So here we are, this agricultural state, and I think it's a big surprise for people to learn that we're only growing about 3% of the food we eat here. And just as you mentioned in the lead into the show about how we spend so much money and send it out of state buying in energy, we do the very same thing with our food supply. So the rough number I came up with as part of my preliminary research behind developing the bill was that we're sending over $2 billion, 2.6 was the figure I came up with, buying that food in.
$2.6 billion leaves Vermonters' pockets and goes out of state to buy food.
Right. So that's an approximate number. And part of the reason to do all this work in Farm to Plate is to actually look at these numbers again and get better figures. But this was based on some data from the 90s, just updated to reflect inflation. So,
and how much is a state general fund budget each year?
That's about the same number of dollars as the state budget, less federal money, is around $2.5 billion, and then another $2 billion or so of federal money. So yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it helps put it into scale. It's a very large figure. And so the opportunity is to start buying more, growing more of the food that we eat in state. And by purchasing from our neighbors or purchasing Vermont food or even regional food, we'll keep that money circulating in the local economy. So if you start with $2.6 billion, we'll just use that as a rough figure for a conversation. And you say, what would happen if we grew 10% more of our own food? So that gives you, you know, immediately you're sending $260 million less out of state. And then with anything that circulates in the local economy, you get a multiplier effect. In agriculture, I've generally heard figures from 2 to 7. So let's pick a modest 2. And now we're up to $260 million becomes $520 million.
And the multiplier effect means that the farmer in state receives that money from the Vermont consumer instead of the money leaving the state. And then the farmer goes and buys feed from the local feed store, buys clothing at the local clothing store, probably buys some groceries at the grocery store, but anyway, spends the money locally, right?
Right, exactly. And I think agriculture actually has one of the highest multipliers because almost every farm expenses related to something in the community. So whether it's tractors, feed, grain, doctors, you know, you name it.
It's vets.
It's usually a local expense. Mm. And that becomes money that stays in the local economy and someone else's wage that they earn and then they spend locally. So it has a great way. It's a great way to be developing our own economy. And it doesn't involve, I think importantly from my point of view, it doesn't involve taking on any new debt. Lots of times when people talk about growing a project, they're talking about taking on debt in order to do that. This is simply shifting our current spending from an out-of-state supplier to an in-state supplier.
Do we get less food for it? I mean, are out-of-state suppliers cheaper?
I'd say in general, yes. You know, I think, you know, you've put your finger on one of the challenges that we're going to face. When you're buying from agribusiness, I mean, we are in the age of cheap food. There are consequences to consuming that cheap food, and everyone has their own way of making individual choices when they go shopping. But I'd say, based on my experience shopping at farm stands, co-ops, farmers markets, CSA shares. Well, CSA shares are different, I think. But it's generally, I think, we spend more in my family buying food than we used to just in the grocery store. But we're happy doing so because of the quality of the food.
Mm. Yeah. Some people argue that the quality of the food means that while you may spend more per item, your total bills can be the same or less. For example, Robin McDermott has been on this show from the Mad River Localvores and been saying that when we get greens from the farmer's market, they're so much fresher that they last longer and we have less wastage. And the chickens that we get locally, we use all parts of those. We're quite comfortable using all parts of those, whereas we may be throwing away some of the parts of the chickens we get from the store.
Sure. And I think for the food, well, I think many people have probably heard the figure that food in general travels 1,500 miles to reach sort of the average American plate, whatever that is. And
it's in Iowa.
In Iowa.
According to that study.
Uh-huh. And I've heard figures that there's 15, 20, 30% waste as food travels that far, as it's handled multiple times, goes to different distributors, finally gets to the store and to your home. Mm. So part of the increase in expense, I think, will be balanced off by having less waste.
Right.
And the other thing, too, is the program is, this isn't necessarily just a farm-to-plate vision, but my own sense of where I'd like to see the state going is that all people have access to fresh local foods regardless of income. And I think there are projects like the Two Rivers Project in Montpelier that's doing great work on just that issue.
Mm. So we're talking with Representative Chris Bray from New Haven. You're listening to Equal Time Radio. And we're talking about the Farm to Plate program, which is trying to keep food dollars in Vermont, dollars that we're spending here anyway. And it's the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund, which is carrying out the studies for the Farm to Plate program. Executive Director Ellen Kaler is on the line with us. And Ellen, again, welcome. And why don't you tell us what the status of your work is with Farm to Plate right now?
Sure. Thanks. The House Commerce, the House Agriculture, the Senate Agriculture, and the Senate Economic Development Committees this past legislative session is responsible for initiating the Farm to Plate, what they called the investment program, actually. And they asked the Jobs Fund to develop a 10-year strategic plan for agriculture in Vermont. And that's what we're trying to accomplish by June 30 of next year, a very aggressive timeline. But we've hit the ground running. We've employed a number of researchers that are taking a look at existing agriculture and food sector data from both in Vermont and around the country. We're examining other state initiatives where they have done similar projects to try to see what we can learn from those places around the country. We have been scouring through the vault, literally the vault at the Agency of Agriculture, looking at historical documents about agriculture in Vermont and trends over time. We've been reading through reports and feasibility studies and documents that have been produced over the last 5 to 10 years, again, so that we're not duplicating efforts. We're really trying to glean the best thinking that has come about to now about how do you actually expand the food and farm sector in Vermont, both from a local production perspective, a local consumption perspective, as well as how to access regional markets like in Boston and New York City, and how do we help our farmers here in Vermont get a higher value for the products that they produce. I mean, we've all been hearing so much about this past summer about milk pricing and farmers that are being paid half of their production costs for the milk itself, and so they're losing money hand over fist because of the way our existing milk system has been set up. So we're trying to uncover some alternatives, some other ways of structuring Vermont's food and farm sector over the coming 10 years. We're doing a lot of outreach. By the end of this month, we'll have met with about 50 different stakeholder groups, and we're actually going to be conducting 8 local food summits around the state in the month of November. So we're hoping to talk to literally thousands of Vermonters to really try to get people's perspective on what are the strengths and weaknesses of our agriculture and food and farm sector. What are some of the opportunities that are out there? We have this incredible growing local vore movement and people's understanding of food and where it comes from watching the documentary Food Inc. or King Corn, or learning more about our food system, sort of really taking more and more interest in how do I eat more locally or within the region, and then understanding some of the threats that our food and farm sector faces in terms of new regulation or global issues or food safety issues from a way that have a way of really hurting a local industry because of the way the press attention happens to it. So we're just talking with everybody we possibly can, going to different existing events, holding our own events, meeting with people one-on-one, and seeing where we can get to.
So if you talked or will by the end of this month have talked with 50 stakeholder groups, then a good number of the listeners who are interested in agriculture issues may already have been part of those groups. But if somebody is listening and wants to give some input on what they think the food strategy should be, or what problems they as farmers are having in finding markets, or they as eaters are having in finding affordable local food, is there a way for them to do that?
Absolutely. Best thing to do is visit our website, which is vsjf.org. It's the acronym for Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. And we have an online survey that folks can fill out. There's also email contact addresses for getting on our monthly e-news update. You can send us your thoughts, and we'll be adding it to the thousands of others. Folks' thoughts out there in Vermont, as well as regionally, about how best to grow our farm and food sector and how to support farmers and grow this important part of our economic development machine in Vermont.
And that's, again, vsjf.org, the Vermont Sustainable Job Fund website. And we will have a link to that website when we have the audio for today's show up at the equaltimeradio.com website, which
Carl,
I expect will be tomorrow.
Carl, just wanted to let folks know that our plan is to try to collect as much input as possible by the end of the calendar year, and then we'll be in a writing phase, and then our hope is that next spring we'll actually be taking the draft plan out on the road and getting additional comments and feedback on folks.
And you also mentioned 8 local food summits in November. Those sounds like things that might be open to members of the public.
Absolutely. We are in the process of nailing down dates and locations right now. Again, if you check our website, within the next couple weeks, we should have all of that lined up. We're collaborating with the Vermont Sustainable Ag Council and with a number of the local food system groups around the state that have been emerging, stakeholder groups. We're going to be co-hosting it. Those regional meetings, and there'll be a series of meetings. Actually, the one in the evening will be for anyone and everyone that's interested in this topic to come in and share their thoughts.
Well, Ellen Kalin, director of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. I am part of the Central Vermont Food Systems Council, and we had our steering committee meeting last week, and one of the things we sat around scratching our heads about was, what's a farm and what's a farmer? As we were trying to figure out what farm and farming resources were available right now in the Central Vermont region. Do you have a working definition of those?
Well, one of the things that's going to be part of the strategic plan is a long series of definitions explaining just that. I mean, there are any number of types of farms, and that's one of the things that we're really being clear about is we're really talking about all types of farms. We're talking about dairy. We're talking about fruits and vegetables. There's maple sugaring operations. There's cheese producers. There are any number of entities that are producing part of our food system. And you also have farms that are transitioning to energy production, for instance. You actually have farms that are contemplating being actual energy farms, in addition to being able to supply some of their own on-farm energy needs through their own means right there on the farm. So I can't give you a quick definition right now, but it is definitely going to be something that we're going to be working hard to nail down exactly, because there's a lot of definitions that are floating around out there. What is a food system? What's local? That's a big one for folks right now, is what do you mean by local?
One of the complaints that I hear from people who are involved in farming is, on a small scale especially, is that state regulations make it illegal to farm profitably at the small scale. We had a caller, Ray from Woodbury, who called in a July show where Chris Bray was on the last time and talked about requirements back in the 50s to have concrete floors in barns, and then the pasteurization requirements for milk. Those got scaled back a little bit in legislation this last year. As part of the farm-to-plate program, do you expect to be looking at legal barriers as well?
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. We're actually hoping to have some very clear information about the kinds of regulatory framework that exists for small, medium, and large farms, so that everybody can really see what the existing regulations are and what applies to whom. And then out of that, out of this plan, not only will there be, you know, an awful lot of background information and goal setting and strategy development, but there'll also be a series of recommendations. And I wouldn't be surprised if there are some very concrete recommendations going to the legislature around policy and regulatory frameworks.
Hmm. Chris Bray, let's get back to you. Farm to plate. What other aspects of farm to plate would you like our listeners to know about?
Well, I think, you know, for me personally, one of the more intriguing sides of farm to plate is that over time, as we, I think, provide more fresh, local, whole foods to Vermonters, that we'll start to see a dividend in the area of health. And it may be that someday the health benefits of eating healthier diet will exceed sort of the value of the, you know, the farm gate price for things. And that may sound a bit far-fetched, but we've really, as a nation, well, I'll just back up to one quick report. In 2005, the National Institute of Health published a report that said that children born today will have a shorter, less healthy life than their parents. And
what year was that?
2005. Mm-hmm. And to me, this was something like the 9/11 of national health. I mean, I thought that that report would trigger a deep conversation about how did we develop a system that, however unintentionally, has led to this kind of outcome. And instead, you know, worrisomely, that item disappeared out of the news, and I've heard very little about it since, until just lately. And I think we have literally a pediatric obesity epidemic in the United States. Today, one out of three children born today will become diabetic in his or her lifetime. We're looking at record levels of things like cardiovascular disease. And I just saw a report, you know, it's preliminary numbers, but that it's roughly $1,500 a year for the healthcare system to take care of someone who's obese compared to non-obese.
So you think people getting access to fresh local food will help with the healthcare side of things as well?
I do.
Very good. We're going to go to the phones. This may be one of your constituents, Representative Chris Bray. This is Kip from New Haven. Hello, Kip.
Hi, gentlemen.
Hi, Kip.
Hey, what's up?
Question for you would be, can you speak to at least any efforts in the schools for school cafeterias to serve local food? I mean, do you offhand know if Beeman does any buys any local stuff? I mean, given the fact that there's a chicken farm on the other side of the wire on the playground there,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
You wonder if that's a good way to get people thinking about it, especially because sometimes it takes a generation for things to, you know, really really change. So anyway, if you could speak to that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, well,
thanks for the question.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great question, and it really opens the door into a topic that's a very positive part of what's been going on in Vermont for a decade now already. We have it's not actually happening to the extent I'd love to see it happen in our hometown, New Haven, but there's a farm-to-school program that pairs local farmers with local schools in order to do a couple things. One is to get more food into that local, fresh local food into that school. And the other thing is, depends on how the particular school implements it, but they often involve field trips to the farm. So they learn something about agriculture. And that might seem like, why would you need to bother to do that in Vermont? But it's there have been surveys about with Vermont preschoolers about what kind of animals, you know, live in Vermont and on farms. And the answers include things like zebras. So we need to educate people about farming and what goes on, as well as it's a great opportunity to get local foods into school. And I'd say we have an obligation, since we're helping form eating habits for that generation as they go K through 12, to help them form as healthy an eating habit as possible. And I think that includes things like, you know, fresh local foods.
We have yak farmers and water buffalo farmers and emu farmers. Are you sure we don't have any zebra farmers here in Vermont?
Well, actually, I did see a zebra down by Woodstock, but I don't think he was, I don't think he's on his way to the market yet.
Okay. Also, Kip, I can tell you that there's a one-time benefit concert in Montpelier on Saturday as part of a local food celebration there, and part of the object was to raise money for an initiative to put a garden in every school in Washington County. So that's part of the Central Vermont Food Systems Council work.
Right.
Well, we're just about out of time for this first section of our show, where we're talking about the Farm to Plate program, how to keep our food dollars spent in Vermont rather than shipped out of state. Ellen Kaler is overseeing the planning process at the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. Ellen, do you have any final words on the subject?
Well, just really interested in hearing from folks right now. And so if you go to our website and fill out the survey, we'd really appreciate it.
And that's vsjf.org is a website. And again, that will be on the equaltimeradio.com website when this audio is posted, probably by the end of Tuesday. Ellen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. And thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Ellen.
All right, bye-bye.
And Chris Bray will be remaining with us for the rest of the show. We're going to be changing subject to be talking. We've been talking about food in the local economy. We're going to be talking about energy in the local economy, the work of the Biomass Energy Development Working Group to figure out how much we can substitute locally grown biomass, wood, and other things for oil, keep our money in the state for that as well. We'll be back right after this. Back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettner, and we're talking about how to keep our dollars here in Vermont, promote local economic development. We send a lot of money out of state. In the first half of the show, we talked about keeping our food dollars in Vermont, about $2.6 billion a year we send outside of Vermont in this agricultural state to import food from elsewhere. Let's keep at least some portion of it there, and the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund is working to help us out on that. And in this part of the show, we're going to be talking about our heating needs. Vermont is unusually dependent on oil for heating of all the U.S. states. It's about 60% of the buildings that rely on oil, but we also use propane, gas, and none of these fossil fuels are found here in Vermont. So it means we're sending all that money out of state, or at least you look at your bill and some portion of it stays with the local company that provides you with the fuel, but the vast majority of it goes out of state. How can we keep that money here? And how much can our Green Mountains and their forests and also our fields and the biomass we grow there, how much can they supply us with the raw materials for heating? Love to hear your comments and questions on this. Our local number is 244-1777. Our toll-free number is 877-291-8255. 8255. And continuing with us this hour is State Representative Chris Bray. He's from New Haven. And later on in the show, we'll be talking with Gwen Hallsmith. She's a planning director for the City of Montpelier. And the City of Montpelier is teaming with the state and a private company to plan a district heating plant for downtown Montpelier that will use biomass. And Chris, why don't you give us the overview now of the Biomass Energy Development Working Group?
Sure. Thanks, Carl. This group, which was established by Act 37, we just passed it this spring, has two goals. One is to enhance and develop Vermont's biomass industry, and while doing so, to protect forest health. So this particular group is actually focusing mostly on forest-based, forest-derived biomass. We're very much aware that there's biomass that comes off of farms, and it's not the focus of our work, but we're certainly partnering and in conversation with those folks so that we look for an overall solution for the state of Vermont that creates a coherent plan. But again, so we're focusing mostly on forest. And I think right now, forest-derived biomass contributes about 6% to our energy portfolio in the state. And I think it breaks down into, you know, there's a good portion of it in wood chips. That's, I think, what people may be familiar with, the McNeil heating plant up in Burlington, a 50-megawatt.
Except McNeil doesn't heat a thing.
Right.
All that heat is wasted.
Right.
It goes to electricity.
Heating. It's a generating plant, yeah. And it's generating only. And that gets into a whole interesting question. I know that when McNeil first came online, people talked about how great to be using a renewable resource to generate electricity. But it's only about 25% efficient. And there are efficiencies in things like combined heat and power that are closer to 75-80%. So there's another whole bit of conversation I look forward to having. So we're, at any rate, there are people, so there are two major chip burning plants. There's Reigate and McNeil. There are roughly 42 schools, I think, in the state of Vermont that burn chips to heat the schools. And then there are a variety of other facilities around. And then we shouldn't forget cordwood. There are an awful lot of people burning cordwood in the state of Vermont still, and wood stoves at home. And then more recently, pellets. So wood ground up, pulverized, turned into little nuggets and dried and then bagged and delivered to people.
That's funny because I think of burning cordwood to keep the house warm as Vermont, as plaid shirts and chicken pot pie dinners. And you say, all together, pellets plus chips plus cordwood is only 6% of our heating needs right now.
Right, right. It's actually, I guess it goes to show how much energy we consume. And it's relatively invisible, you know, delivered through the grid, stuff like that. So we don't appreciate how much power we consume rather invisibly by just throwing a switch. As opposed to the whatever it is with cordwood, you know, it warms you three times or five times.
Right. Or even the propane truck or the oil truck, they show up and they're there for some minutes filling the tank and then they leave and they're not back for another month or so, whereas that stack of cordwood is always visible.
Yeah, that's right.
What's going on then? Here's a problem. We're spending too much money. How much money are we sending out of state? I did a calculation on that.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to remember. I think it's roughly a billion, 1.1, something like that. So again, I feel like I'm riding the same horse in two different bills here. They're both about, you know, the farm to plate bill is about relocalizing our own food system and food production. And the biomass bill is about relocalizing more of our own energy production.
So a little over $1 billion a year we're sending out of state for energy, just for heating. That's not counting transportation at all.
Right. Yeah. So there's a big opportunity again to take an industry that's, to take money that's being exported and to spend it in state. And that's, you would be employing loggers and foresters, paying landowners, people who are chipping, delivering, installing all the equipment that combusts this and maintaining it.
So you've got a group of people who are sitting around in four meetings this year and talking about this. How is that going to help?
Well, sure. So the at this point, because there isn't a state policy around biomass, what we're trying to figure out is how do we make come to a consensus and make a plan to move forward in the most thoughtful way. And I'd say, you know, environmentally and economically, positive way for the state of Vermont. I think if you wanted to look at two different camps, you know, there are people who would love to see us cutting and chipping more, and there's a group of people who on sort of the other pole that would say, you know, our forests provide tremendous value just as they stand by purifying water, providing habitat, diversity for animals, there's a recreation, lots of things. So let's not cut. And like everything, rather than have it black and white, we're looking to find a balanced approach forward. That's why in the same sentence in the goal of the bill, it says enhance and develop as well as maintain forest health. And that's what the challenge is that we're moving forward. So we've created two working groups. One is focusing on how do we enhance and develop as an industry? What's holding us up? Why have I heard for as long as I can remember we could create more of our own energy here, and we don't seem to do that much more in any one year? You know, there's incremental progress, but maybe we could be doing more. At the same time, I think as you know, the earth is loaned to us. The place we live is, you know, loaned to us. We're stewards while we're here, and people want to make sure that we're taking good care of the environment. And I think that's a, you know, there was a Council on the Future of Vermont study that interviewed thousands of people in the last year, and one of the highest levels of agreement was over the notion that we should maintain our healthy working landscape. So people want to see farm and forest used, but they want to make sure that we're doing it in a way that's environmentally sensitive and that we are going to keep this a healthy state to live in.
Hmm. Now, last half hour, when we were talking about food, then we got a call from your constituent, Kip, in New Haven, who was asking, what's going on with local food in schools? And that's, you know, doubly important because, you know, schools have the buying power and they also have the education power. Next generation of citizens is growing up in today's schools. So let me ask Kip's question about biomass energy. What's going on right now with biomass energy in schools? What do we need to be doing there?
Huh. Well, that's a great question, and I think I have to confess you're a step ahead of me. Mm-hmm. You know, there's more for me to learn. I think the fact that we have 40-plus schools now with wood chip facilities in them provides a certain amount of education for often these projects come out of a group of students and or teachers in combination working along with the school board to say, you know, this is something we'd like to do. It makes sense. I mean, as you were saying, burning wood is sort of as like plaid shirts. It's part of the local tradition. And schools around the state have been building these facilities. So I suppose that we have sort of living laboratories in 40-plus schools now, but there's more to be done in terms of, I think, people gaining a broader education about how biomass can be used in the state. And we're not really talking today about it, but there's many of the new things that are happening are on farms. Mm. Actually, the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund also has a whole area of research and development and on the farm-based energy.
Hmm. Well, very good. Well, we're going to be talking in just a minute with Gwen Hall-Smith. She is the planning director of the City of Montpelier, and she'll be talking about a concrete project that they're planning to heat their downtown area, including state and commercial buildings, with biomass. So we'll be back with Gwen on the line in just a minute. Welcome back to Equal Time Radio on WDEV AM and FM. I'm Carl Ettenayer, your Monday host, and EqualTimeRadio.com is our website. We'll have the audio of today's show up probably by the end of the day tomorrow, along with links to some of the websites pertinent to today's conversation. I also have a blog on the same subject. It's at the Vermont Commons website, vtcommons.org. and then you can write /blog if you want, or just click blog when you get to the main site. I'm one of the many bloggers there. Mine is called Relocalizing Vermont, so look for the posts that say Relocalizing Vermont in the headline. We're talking about biomass energy in Vermont and how we can use it to substitute for the oil that we spend so much money and all that goes out of state, the oil that we use to heat our buildings. And with us on the line now is Planning Director for the City of Montpelier, Gwen Hallsmith. Gwen, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So I'd like to hear from you about the district heating plant that you would like to see built in Montpelier. And why don't you begin by explaining to us why it makes sense to put the boiler for a whole district in one plant rather than have lots of buildings with decentralized small boilers like we have now?
Well, in Montpelier, there's a number of unique reasons for that, not the least of which is the fact that we're in a floodplain, as you know, and having all those boilers in all the separate buildings in downtown Montpelier constitutes a flood hazard, as well as a maybe more inefficient way to deliver heat to highly centralized and compact buildings.
Hmm. So by a flood hazard, you mean they're vulnerable to damage in floods?
Well, they're susceptible to damage, but they also come with each of their own individual fossil fuel tanks that are at risk of rupturing or floating away or otherwise polluting the water when it floods. So that alone makes it a good idea just from a public safety and hazards point of view. But in addition to that, the efficiency that's achieved with one central plant as opposed to a number of plants is much higher, and the reliability and the cost are much more predictable for the participants involved. We know that we've entered an era where fuel prices, at least fossil fuel prices, are fluctuating dramatically. And wood prices, because they're locally produced and otherwise much more predictable, are more stable. All the studies that we've done so far show that if people sign on to our system, they can expect between a 15 and 20% overall reduction in their fuel bills, and that is with current fuel prices, obviously. If we start to see the kind of prices we had this time last year, that savings could be much greater.
Hmm. So what type of fuel would this biomass district heating plant use?
Right now we're looking at sustainably harvested wood chips.
Hmm.
But a solid fuel facility obviously can use a number of different kinds of solid fuels over the course of its lifetime with minimal adaptation.
So pellets would be easy to retrofit?
A potential fuel in the future, as well as once they finally perfect the ability to separate out different types of solid waste, like construction and demolition debris, for example, has a lot of biomass in it that actually can be considered sustainable biomass. That also might be a possibility down the road, but way down the road. They have not come anywhere near close to perfecting that technology yet, so it's not something we're currently looking at.
And you've just applied for a grant from the federal government to take the next step on this plant. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Yes. The Department of Energy offered a series of community renewable energy grants nationwide. They're going to be giving out $22 million, and the minimum application amount was $5 million, with 100% match by the member communities. So this is a very competitive program. There's only going to be a maximum of 4 given out in the entire country.
So what makes Montpelier attractive to that?
Well, what I'm hoping is the fact that we have put together a local, state, and private partnership to build the facility and maintain it over time might be very appealing to the federal government, especially since Montpelier is a capital city of one of our key forest product states. So I'm hoping that that will help make us competitive, but it's one of those grants where you put it in and you don't hold your breath until you hear about it because you may not ever see the result.
Sure. And this plant is sized, as I understand it, to provide the heating needs with electricity as a bonus. Can you explain why it would be sized that way rather than, say, to provide electricity all year round?
Well, if you size a plant for electric generation, there are a number of difficulties that come with that, one of which is the volume of water that would be needed to provide the cooling for the generation system, because creating an electric generation plant is basically looking at something on the scale of the McNeil plant up in Burlington.
Mm-hmm.
And it's questionable whether we would be able to provide the cooling and electric grid infrastructure that would be needed for that kind of facility within Montpelier's boundary.
Mm.
You know, without moving into a neighboring town, that's a fairly large facility, actually.
Right. And we're going to go to the phone now, Gwen. We have a caller from Woodbury. Ray, welcome back to the show. We're just talking about you last hour.
Yeah, I heard you. Mm. I was out of signal areas. So I couldn't call in.
Mm. What's up?
My question is that what is the loss? I guess what's going on here is you got a central plant and you're passing off the heating to different buildings around Montpelier. Is that what I'm hearing?
Gwen?
That's what we're planning. That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what is the efficiency? How much heat do you lose going, you know, I don't know how far apart these buildings will be, but you must lose some of the ability to heat over the distance that you have to get the heat to the buildings.
Actually, that used to be a lot more true with district facilities than they are now. The pipe technology has advanced fairly substantially, so that now the pipes that move the hot water between the buildings are very, very well insulated, and there isn't a large loss of energy, heat energy, from the plant to the building at the outskirts.
Okay, I lost you, so
the pipe, the answer is in well-insulated pipes.
Okay, well, thanks for the call, Ray. And we're just about out of time here, and I want to make sure we have a chance for State Representative Chris Bray to make some final comments on the biomass energy.
Well, you know, I guess this project has just gotten underway. We've had our second meeting, but I have a lot of confidence in where we're going and what we'll achieve because of the group of people. It's a 15-member panel, and it has loggers, foresters, environmentalists. Jonathan Wood from the Agency of Natural Resources is the co-chair, and we have a great cast of people all the way from landowners through people who are buying and selling power onto the grid. So we have great expertise in the room and a lot of experience, and I think people have already shown that they're interested in working together creatively, and so I sense that we're on the right path to coming up with a good, positive Vermont solution.
Hmm. Well, Chris Bray, representative from New Haven, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
And Gwen Hallsmith, planning director for the City of Montpelier, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Carl.
I'm Carl Etnayer, and that's it for Monday's Equal Time. And I also want to thank our callers, Ray and Kip. Good to hear from you. Love to hear from you and other callers in future shows. I'll be back next Monday at 1 o'clock with a similar theme, food, energy, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. Artie Levine produced today's show, and the Equal Time website is equaltimeradio.com. Remember my blog at vermontcommons.org. That's vtcommons.org. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
When gasoline prices hit $6 per gallon, that will be the death of the SUV. The behemoth vehicle was badly wounded at 2008's $4 and $5 gasoline, and the jump to $6 will finish it off. That's the argument Forbes magazine writer Chris Steiner makes in his book, $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Your Life for the Better. I'm going to be a bit whimsical this week and talk about one of the more unlikely replacements for SUVs, pedicabs. What's a pedicab? It's a pedal-powered taxicab. Another name, bicycle rickshaw, captures the appearance pretty well. Most have three wheels, one in front and two in back. If you look just at the front wheel and back to the chauffeur's seat and pedals, it looks like a bicycle. But the pedals drive the two back wheels, and passengers sit on a seat behind the chauffeur between the wheels. Note that I said chauffeur. That's the word I used to describe myself when I worked part-time as a pedicab chauffeur in the 1990s in Oslo, Norway. I was going to graduate school south of Oslo and wanted some extra income so I could afford to live among the bright lights of the big capital city. From an income perspective, it worked out pretty well. I made $100 an hour, including breaks, on 5 to 7 hour nighttime shifts. It pays to be a chauffeur. My uniform clearly showed I was a chauffeur. It consisted of a tuxedo shirt, black tie, tight black Lycra bicycling shorts, black socks, and bicycling shoes with cleats. On colder nights, I put on long bicycling tights, tails, and a top hat with a wool hat hidden underneath it. I almost didn't make it into pedicabbing. My friend Knut Einar owned a small fleet of pedicabs, and he offered to rent me one on weekends. In the afternoon before the evening I was to debut with a pedicab, Knut Einar put me on the back of one of his pedicabs and pedaled us to a medieval market being held not too far away. I felt terribly important to be ferried around in this style, and I savored other people's reactions. Wherever we went, they looked at us with a mixture of amazement and admiration. After this short demonstration, Knut Einar gave me a lecture on how the pedicab handles differently than a bicycle. Then I was at the handlebars, and Knut Einar was sitting in back enjoying the ride. I thought I was a pretty strong mountain bike rider, but I couldn't get the big vehicle moving nearly as easily as Knut Einar. It was heavy, and it handled funny. This was with only one passenger. I struggled for a while, and then he took over and drove us home. I was dejected. How could I afford that apartment in Oslo if I was too weak to pedicab? I decided to take the pedicab out that evening anyway, but not to pick up any passengers. Since it was my strength I was primarily worried about, I headed uphill. And that's not too hard to do in Oslo. After a while, I paused at a corner in a residential neighborhood, trying to decide where to go next. Out of a house came three women in their late 20s, all dressed up for a Friday night on the town. One of them stopped and asked me if I could take them down to Aker Brygge, by the harbor. Well, that surprised me. I didn't intend to take passengers. Since I'd meandered almost randomly uphill, I wasn't even sure how to get to Aker Brygge from there. The women told me they could show me the way, and they assured me it was all downhill. I began to warm up to the idea, and they asked, how much would it cost? To start the haggling, I suggested 60 crowns apiece, about $9 apiece. One looked at the others and said, heck, it's worth it, let's go! Well, that wasn't the bargaining technique I'd expected them to use, but I didn't object. $27 total for my first fare. That's how this Yankee ended up with two Norwegians and a Swede on the back of a Pakistani pedicab, swooping down the hills of Oslo towards the harbor. We bantered back and forth in a mixture of Norwegian and Swedish, in between their loud peals of thrilled laughter. Well, I got stronger, and I went on to chauffeur the pedicab for several years, 1 to 4 nights per month. It's not really much of a replacement for the SUV. My pedicab in Oslo wasn't used as a practical vehicle. Almost everyone took it just for fun, the way they'd ride a merry-go-round or a Ferris wheel. But pedicabs are already established in quite a few U.S. cities, and as gasoline passes $6 a gallon and keeps going up, maybe we'll see them become competitive for practical transportation. Maybe. Until then, they're a blast to ride. If you're in Denver or San Francisco or any other city with pedicabs, give one a try. Be sure to tip well. I'm Carl Etnayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.